Hello and welcome to the Anna Asks podcast. This is another episode from the vault from back in 2023, and then life happened, and here I am editing and releasing it for you in 2024. This is a great in-depth conversation. It was going to be recorded as a two-part interview, and instead I've decided to give it all in one, and I hope that you find as much wisdom and wonderful information and even hope in this as I do. This is a focus on mental health. We know it's important to be on the lookout for signs of postnatal depression, anxiety, even psychosis in the early days, but mental health crises happen down the track too. In this interview, Emmeline shares about her birth and blissful postpartum experiences, how they assisted her in being well, and goes on to explain how personal and societal factors, specifically relating to how society is not set up for mothers and families, influenced the unraveling of her mental health during the toddler years, which of course coincided with the pandemic too. There was an escalation and an eventual experience of psychosis and hospitalization 2.5 years after her child was born, and we recorded this episode another 2.5 years after that. So when we speak about recovery, if you are in the early days, please know that this is a long time. This isn't an overnight process. Emmeline shares her insights into the mental health system, her path to recovery and ongoing mental health management, and how she and her family are seeking to build a life with mental wellness for all as their focus. We also go on a few feministy tangents and discuss books because it's us, and how could we not do that? One note that I did want to make, though, was that seeing as almost 12 months have passed since this recording, in it we discuss homeschooling and our decisions regarding that. And interestingly, both mine and Emmeline's children are in formalized educational environments this year. You'll find a whole lot of information about both of us and some links to things that we refer to in the interview in the show notes. So please check those if you would like to do so. And I will hand it over to us from the past, but please do be aware we do discuss birth, we do discuss medical trauma, we do discuss some serious mental health considerations and pretty heavy experiences. So if these are going to be topics that you might find difficult to listen to at the moment, please do put this aside for a little while and come back or not as you feel ready to. Thanks so much. I hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Anna Asks podcast. I am really pleased to be bringing this conversation with you with my lovely friend Emmeline. We met probably 3.5 years ago now and have traversed some interesting aspects of motherhood through each other's company virtually. We have always lived a good few hours away from each other, if not more, but she's one of those people who I've really lent on through virtual support and voice messaging and text messaging, which in some ways is actually easier than the expectation of catching up with those close by that you end up then just following children around the whole time and not actually speaking to each other. So we've had some really beautiful, deep conversations together, and I'm happy to bring this one for you today, which I expect will go a similar direction. So hi, Emmeline.
Hi.
Nice to have you here in a formal capacity instead of just in my ears day to day.
So happy to be here.
Before we start getting into the content, I do want to acknowledge that we are on unceded Aboriginal land. I am here in a Awabakal country around the Lake Macquarie in Newcastle area, and Emmeline is now in Naam, on the lands of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and the Bunurong peoples and clans of the Kulin Nation. Emmeline, today's topic that we have decided to talk about, because there are many, many that we could have chosen, is around mental health and motherhood. Before we get to that though, I was hoping that you'd be able to introduce yourself, please.
Sure. So my name's Emmeline Tyler. I just recently moved to the inner west of Melbourne with my husband and our 5-year-old child. So I work as a research assistant in linguistics and anthropology, and me and my husband also home educate our child. Yeah. So actually how me and Anna met was through Julia Jones's newborn mothers postpartum support training when I was starting off doing my own business. But as we'll get to, I sort of paused that when I had a mental health crisis, and I'm still really interested in support for mothers and parents, but I haven't gotten quite back into it yet. But I also am a content creator, so I love writing, and I've recently started a YouTube channel about books, and I also am producing a podcast with the aforementioned Julia about autism, which hasn't been released yet.
I'm excited to hear those episodes when they come out.
I know, I'm too excited, but
the topic list that you sent to me sounded incredible.
Yeah, we just need to, you know how it is. What do
Polish
you
it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still a gem in the rough. And we'll get to the books later. You're one of the most voracious readers that I know, and your book recommendations make my choices of what I'm going to read next very simple. It's wonderful. What I would love to start with, though, is to hear about your postpartum experience with your child, who, as you say, is now five, but that probably feels like both a very long time and also only a moment ago.
Yeah, I mean, he turned five at the end of February, and I was stressing about the birthday party because I always do, even though I keep it as low-key as possible. But then I suddenly turned around and was like, but this is also 5 years of me being a parent and my husband as well. That's half a decade. And when he turned one, I bought a greeting card, and me and my husband both wrote on it messages to each other, like congratulations on being a parent for a year. And I was like, we should do that again, because, like, yeah, it's so monumental. But postpartum was really great. I had a wonderful experience. I prepared pretty well for the birth. I wanted to have a home birth, and it wasn't really possible because we couldn't get it through the public system and we didn't have money for a private. And also Matt, who's my husband, wasn't really keen. I mean, I think it's a bit, there's a bit of a gender division. And I was thinking recently, you might be interested in this, Anna. I wonder if there should be like doulas for men, because women get learn, we end up getting marketed all this stuff, good and bad, and we'll be the ones who learn about how great home birth is or homeschooling or whatever it is. But then men are stuck in the mainstream marketing, don't get access to those sort of resources and information. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and then it becomes the woman or the mother or the birth parent's job almost to educate the father and convince them, and increases to all that kind of unpaid work and mental load that is default placed on you already.
But I have access to people like you, or if we weren't friends, I could just I could pay for your services that I get for free. but who are the people like you who do education and support for the men? Like,
yeah,
won't someone think of the men?
I can. How ironic that that's coming up in a conversation of ours. But yes, I can think of one male midwife in all of Australia.
Yep.
Like, the support is minimal. And yes, there's now, for men who are in the city, there's, I think it's called Beers and Bubs, the childbirth education at the pub. It's kind of like outreach to the guys who'd be really, who are, it's really a stretch for them just to go along to a birth class.
So anyway, so he wasn't keen on home birth. So we had a hospital birth. I had a doula who was amazing. I'm still in contact with her. It went as well as it could have for a hospital birth. And then I actually just felt really good afterwards. I remember we saw a neighbor like a day or two after the birth, and he was like, "How was it?" And I was like, "I just feel really empowered." And he laughed at my face, and it was quite a horrible experience. But his wife hadn't had good birth experiences, and so I guess it was just a real shock for him. So he probably wasn't trying to be derisive, but it was empowering and it set me on a good path. Matt was he working at the time? So he's a pilot, and he'd applied for a job with Virgin, and he had basically gotten through but was just waiting to hear. So, you know, when someone checks your references, you're like, "Oh, I'm in." So they'd checked his references and then just hadn't got in touch. So he was just waiting. It was all but certain, but he hadn't gotten started yet. And so I was working as a research assistant before I had the baby. And we went on field work together, and he ended up getting a job for the same company. So he was still working for them, but working from home, probably about 10 hours a week. So he had 4 weeks of leave, and then was only working 10 hours a week, working from home. So he was barely working at all. Like, I don't remember him working. I just remember him being around all the time. And we just had such a nice time. But that's what my postpartum was like. I did go to a prenatal yoga class, and that's when I first learned about Julia and her work. So this woman was, she would give mini workshops in the yoga classes, and one of them was about postpartum care and support, and she would bring in some of the traditional stuff. So she referenced the book The First 40 Days as well as Julia's recipe book, and just made us go around and say what support we were going to have after the birth. So I was like, "Oh, okay." And I hadn't really thought about it. So, but then I got super into it. I bought Julia's recipe book and I learned all about as much as I could. I think with these things, like as Westerners, and especially like white feminists, we can just get really individualistic about these things, but you do really need the cultural and social support to be able to have the supportive, nurturing postpartum that you need. So I needed people around me to remind me, but it was just me reminding people around me that I'm in this space. So for example, it was the day my milk came in, for fuck's sake. We really wanted to buy a carrier for my little one, and they should have just gone without me and taken a freaking teddy bear. But for some reason, me, Matt, and my mum went to Baby Bunting of all places. I have not darkened the door of that store ever since. I'm pretty sure it is the day my milk came in, so can you believe it? And we went there and we found a carrier, which was great. So we used my baby to try the carrier on and everything. And then he was hungry. I needed to feed him, and I couldn't find anywhere to sit down. And so I said to one of the staff members, "Oh, I need somewhere to feed him." And she was like, "Oh, there's a feeding room. There's like a parent's room." So I went there and it was locked, like it was engaged. And then but because she'd sent me there, I just had the message that it wasn't okay for me to feed him in public. And so then I ended up going to the car, but it was like really stressful and horrible. But I should not have been there. I should not have been leaving the house, let alone going to a store. Like, I don't like going to shopping centres at the best of times. And the fact that my two main support people, like, I don't blame them because they just didn't know, but that they were just suggested it. So anyway, I did my best to create the slow postpartum that everyone needs, but it didn't always work. But I was in this baby bliss period for weeks. So like a few days after he was born, the washing machine broke under the load of hundreds of cloth nappies and onesies with vomit on them. and that flooded and it got onto the carpet and it was all this drama. And I was just sitting on the couch breastfeeding and in a love bubble while Matt was running around getting it all sorted for me. And I was just like all loved up towards him and the baby. And it just all passed me by. I was just like, oh, he's just so wonderful. And isn't this great?
That sounds very similar to how I was feeling in my first postpartum as well. It was just, now I reflect on it and I realize that she actually was an incredibly difficult baby. And at the time I was just like, there is nothing more perfect than this. I will have all the babies.
Everything you needed, I guess.
Yeah.
And Matt took over the mental load and all the housework. I mean, later I got upset at him because again, with that, like, not having the, like, having an idea of how I want things to be, but it not being communicated. And I said to Matt, it only lasted for 2 weeks that you did all the housework. And then eventually he came back and said, look, Emmeline, you were literally just hanging out washing. That's all you were doing after 2 weeks. And it was because you wanted to. So I would like have a button down shirt with the buttons undone and hang out the washing and give some sunlight to my poor nipples. So that was my postpartum.
It sounds like you loved it for the most part and that you were really quite mentally well during that time. Is that how you reflect on the period as well and how others do?
So we're probably going to get to something horrible, an interaction that I had with a medical professional later on. And so I recently asked Matt, what was I like in postpartum, like mentally? And he said, you were kind of checked out. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you were just hyper-focused on the baby. And that's what I remember too. So he gave up trying to talk to me while I was breastfeeding because I would just not listen to him, as in like just not take in what he was saying. And I would stop a sentence halfway through and then just start gazing at the baby and completely forget what I was saying. Yeah, I did feel really mentally strong, but just in like an alternative space, which is how it should be, really. It's not a normal time. But I did for a long time, and even now, I categorize that time as postpartum bliss, almost like the opposite of postpartum depression. And it was a boost. It was so because the birth was so good too.
You were still in that, like the oxytocin love bubble continued.
Yeah, and so my son, even though he can ride a bike with pedals, he really likes going on a balance bike. He can scoot along by himself, but he likes it when I push him. And so he says to me, give me the biggest double push ever, ever, ever. And so then I push him and he goes along for a while under that momentum. And that's what it was like for me. So the birth was good and that gave me a push. And then the postpartum experience was good and that gave me a big push too in terms of bolstering me mentally for the experience of parenting and all of the fortitude that I needed because it is hard.
It is bloody hard. Bloody hard. And I love that analogy of the bike too and the push and how you can just coast on that for so long if the conditions are right.
And I mean, ideally, in a better world than the one that we parent in, you're constantly being pushed, but that's not actually our reality.
When do you think that things started to change and tip in the opposite direction for you?
I can state with certainty that it was when he was about 9 months old. So when he was 7 months old, or maybe 6 months old, Matt did eventually get the job working for Virgin. And when he was 7 months old, Matt went to Bangkok for 7 weeks to learn how to fly the aircraft that he was going to be flying. It's called an endorsement. So that was fine. Like, it was hard looking after a baby by myself. Like, I had support, but just, without my partner, as in without him present. because I don't like to appropriate. I call it solo parenting, not single parenting. So, but when he was 9 months old, it's that transition. So some people say that, you know how you have the fourth trimester, the first 3 months after birth. Well, I've heard people say that there's like postpartum comes in, there's the 9 months postpartum have distinct periods. So there's 1 to 3 months and then 4 to 6 and then 6 to 9. So I guess after 9 months, you're sort of moving out of that postpartum phase, even though you'll always be postpartum, but it's into a different way. I don't remember what happened. Like, I remember him pulling off from my boob a lot when he was breastfeeding. I remember breastfeeding becoming harder because he wasn't just a newborn, like suckling away quietly. I was never self-conscious about breastfeeding as like an older child. I didn't give a shit about people seeing my nipple. But if someone was like worried about seeing my nipple, I would just say, if he was eating with a spoon, you'd expect to see the spoon sometimes. So that was my way of like being like, just don't worry. Like, I don't care if you see my nipple. It's contextual. So you don't have to freak out about me breastfeeding in front of you and him pulling off. So that was 9 months. And then I was starting to think, well, I guess I'll just breastfeed until a year then, because this is getting really hard. But I did end up breastfeeding until he was 2 and a half.
So, do you think it was that long period of Matt being away, or is it more so? I had the feeling once when my partner was sick and we had to live apart just for a week or two, and I just thought, you will never understand, you will never be up to the parenting that I can. You will not know this child, that everything is going to fall on me. You'll never catch up because this has changed so much in a short period of time. Like, our paths are separate now. Was there any of that kind of feeling with him having been away for so long? Or do you think it was more just that the child was moving into a different phase, started to get on the move, your perhaps hormonal and social expectations were shifting? What do you think happened around then?
So I do remember something it from that period, which was that we were co-sleeping while Matt was away. And it's funny because Matt's away at the moment doing another endorsement back at Virgin. And my little one and I are co-sleeping again. But I mean, before that, since we moved, he's been sleeping on a cot mattress in the bedroom with us just to help him with the transition. And also because we sold his bed and we haven't bought him a new one in the new house. But back then, when he was 9 months old, we were co-sleeping and he just started breastfeeding like all night, basically. So he would wake up like every hour and a half and have a little snack. And I just started to get so tired. So when Matt got back, we tried kind of traditional sleep training and it was unbearable for both of us. And so then we just continued with how things were. And we eventually did some form of sleep training when he was 13 months old, I think. Yeah, I think that period of when he just went back to co-sleeping and breastfeeding and my sleep was so interrupted, which for some reason when you've got a newborn, it just feels different. But I mean, toddlers are hard to share a bed with.
They're very wriggly, very, very wriggly, especially ones that are very persistent, wriggly, looking for snacks. And it is a really common time for the overnight rate of breastfeeding to actually increase rather than decrease. And part of that, I think, is because they're so active and on the go during the day that they start to somewhat reverse cycle and drink extra in the night. But I also had a baby who was possibly like yours, who was just that, like, every hour, hour and a half feeder around the clock, regardless of whether it was day or night. So it didn't feel like reverse cycling. It just felt like constant. It's exactly at that time period that people, a lot of parents, go, okay, well, this is unbearable. Let's look towards sleep training of some kind when we know that in an ideal world, we just have the support for the baby to do what they need to do and us feel supported rather than looking to that kind of solution. But that's kind of all the options that we're presented with sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, I have worked, you've been really helpful with me in working through my guilt around that. It was annoying because the book said that it's consistent. You can use it when you're co-sleeping, but then practically didn't explain how to do that. So we did have to put him, you know, have to, using the method, put him in his own room, but it sort of broke the cycle. And at the same time, I night weaned him, which was, I was pretty happy with how I did that. So it was like measure, this wouldn't work for everyone. I mean, nothing works for everyone, but timed how long he was breastfeeding for over a period of time, so to get an average, and then cut him off by 30 seconds every second night. Isn't that like, it sounds so ridiculously scientific now, but it did work.
Sounds like something that would prevent me going back to sleep and I would just throw it out the window in about 2 days.
Totally.
That's at 9 months. Where's the rock bottom point? What happened in between in terms of the internalized pressures of mothers of society building up during that period of time? Or yeah, what's the next progression? Because it sounds like it's gone blissful at the start, hard patch, and then sometimes it picks up from there and sometimes it goes downhill. So what happened?
So 9 months was when things got hard. 13 months was when we sleep trained him. And then 18 months, I was like, I remember posting to, I won't name them, but it was a Facebook group for breastfeeding support, but like not just breastfeeding support, but like radical pro breastfeeding. It was 18 months and I posted in the group saying, I'm really struggling with breastfeeding. I'm finding it really hard. I need some help. I think I need to wean him. And the mods or admin or whatever, as well as other people, commented, and it just hit me so harsh. And they linked to articles, and it was just like handing me a huge dose of mum guilt. Like, here you go, feel guilty. Saying World Health Organization recommends till 2 years, because I had it in my head that they had it until 1 year or maybe 18 months, and you just need to get more support. And it's funny because it's the kind of advice that you would give, Anna, but you would give it in a loving way. So they were saying, the message I got anyway was, you must breastfeed, and you can't stop breastfeeding until the child stops breastfeeding. And if they stop breastfeeding before 2 years, it's not a wean, it's not a self-wean, it's a nursing strike. So you absolutely have to just, like, if that child stops breastfeeding, you have to keep forcing them to breastfeed. But anyway, you must breastfeed, and to support that, then you need to get help. Like, maybe someone can cook meals for you, or is there some way that people could take the load off you in other ways so that you can continue with this goal of breastfeeding? But this made me quite angry, because I was like, but that's not what I came to say. I came to say that I'm struggling and I need to stop breastfeeding, and you're telling me you're not allowed to stop breastfeeding.
There are so many things that could have been said at that point in time, and that's not the kind of help that you were looking for.
And it goes back to what I was saying at the start about society support. And I was like, I get what you're saying, but nobody in my life, even though everyone was super supportive of me breastfeeding, like, no one was judging me for breastfeeding at 18 months. Like, and if they were, they weren't saying anything. But there's no social support to be like, we need to help Emmeline keep breastfeeding. There's no context for that. Does that make sense? Like, there's a context for people bringing you meals in the first 6 weeks, but there's no context for people bringing you meals so that you can continue to breastfeed your toddler.
And I think as well, there's also this very different take on what's happening at different ages too. I think it actually might have been in a conversation with you where there was at some age that my first was at, I also saying, you know, it's so intense, I'm so tired, blah, blah, blah. And one of the thoughts was, well, isn't she just feeding morning and night by now? And at that point, like, I didn't stop feeding my toddler on demand until she was after two. I absolutely ran myself into the ground, like, feeding her sort of 12 times a day because she was not weaning down by herself. And I had also had that two-year goal in my mind so fixated on it. We're kind of said, like, oh, you can keep breastfeeding, sure, but they don't say, well, like, but it's actually fine if you only want to breastfeed once a day, or it's actually fine if you want to stop, because a healthy mother and parent is going to be much better than that little dose of milk every day.
And also, my little one obviously still wanted that, and that is completely biologically normal for him, and no one was supporting him for that. I was the only one who was supporting him in that goal. Does that make sense? Like, no one ever thinks about it this way. So the other thing that I wanted to mention that I forgot before, I'm actually autistic, and that is not what we're talking about today, but it is relevant. So when I was pregnant, I learned a lot about, well, not a lot, but I came across attachment parenting and stuff, and I learned about the fourth trimester. And so I had it in my head. I was like, okay, my little one needs to be held at all times for the first 3 months of his life. And so sometimes, like, if he was napping in his rocker, I remember once I had an older family member visiting at the same time as my sister, and he was napping in his rocker. And my sister just picked him up to, like, cuddle him while he napped. And the older family member kind of scolded her a bit for that and was like, oh, you know, I know it's really nice to cuddle a baby while they're napping, but you need to leave him. And she just didn't. She ignored the advice or scolding or whatever you want to call it, because she knew that that was my goal, that that's what I wanted. So she was very confident that she was being in line with my parental wishes. But I was very black and white about it. Matt was more in tune with, he doesn't want to be held right now, because sometimes he didn't. And he would say he actually wants to have some intro time, which is something that we used to refer to each other. I need some intro time. It's like
introspective time, yeah. Like personal space time,
introvert time, time by yourself. So yeah, that was interesting. Like, for the most part, I was extremely intuitive as a mother of a baby, but I did get these things in my head. And it was the same with breastfeeding. And like you, yeah, I ran myself ragged because I was supporting his desire to keep breastfeeding, and I knew that it was biologically normal. But now talking to you makes me think that I wish that I'd been supported in that, like, in the way that the breastfeeding extremists were saying, but, like, with a different context than what they were saying it in.
Yeah. So you got loaded up with this unhelpful advice at 18 months. And you've mentioned before you didn't end up ceasing breastfeeding until 2.5. So obviously there's been a continuation beyond that point, because the support to wean, which probably would have been in better line with what your mental health requirements were at the time and support possibilities were you just really low for a lot of the year, or did it snowball, or which direction did it head?
It probably waxed and waned on how frustrated I was feeling or how much I liked it. And I do remember going back to when he was 9 months old and I was feeling quite depleted. And I went to my GP and I was like, I'm tired all the time. And he ran some bloods and said, there's nothing wrong, but maybe your B's a bit low, so go and get a multi B vitamin, whatever, I'm not medical. And I walked away and I was like, and then I went to my mother's group and told them this story and how dismissive he was. And one of the other mums said, oh, just called being a mum then. I don't know if she was joking or not, but I was like, something in me rose up and I was like, that's not good enough. I will not accept that this is just what it's like being a mum. And so that's when I went to a naturopath and she put me on nutrients and because I was like, the baby will get what he needs. When I had folate when I was pregnant, but nothing else. And I thought breastfeeding nutrients were just probably a waste of money. She says, maybe it's for you because you're getting depleted by breastfeeding. So I did get that support. But yeah, at about 20 months was when we both did Julia's course, and I just started to see things in a whole new way. I learned that postpartum lasts until 2 years in terms of the amount of intense support that you need. And I remember emailing with Julia about it and her saying, yeah, but it's not just 2 years, Emmeline. It's forever. We're humans. We're interdependent. We need support. Everyone needs support sometimes or a lot of times. And mums of young kids need a lot of support. And that was just such a paradigm shift for me that I'd never come across. I called my business Project Village because I thought, well, we all need a village. And now I disagree with people using the word village. It's not as bad as you don't like people saying tribe.
Yeah, tribe is my bugbear word. I'll link a couple of articles in the show notes as to why I don't like it. But let's continue on with your story.
So I don't like super like village either, because it just seems also appropriative. Not in the same way. Not as bad, but also appropriative, because it's also a bit overused as well. So I don't like it anymore. But I did have that feeling that so many mums do of, where is my village and where do I find it and why I don't have the support that I deserve and need. Later, when I became really mentally unwell, I had an older family member, reflect to Matt, who then relayed it to me, that maybe this whole time that I got really into the business, I was trying to, it was like a cry for help in a way. I was trying to get the support that I wanted for myself. But pretty much the whole time I deluded myself that I was fine and that I'd had this special experience because I'd had such a great immediate postpartum, right? And I was like, I had a great experience, and most people who become postpartum support professionals do it because they had a bad experience, but not me. I want everyone to have as good experience as I did.
That was exactly my path too. Brilliant fourth trimester. Wanted to share how it was with everyone and shout it from the rooftops and bring everyone along for this most incredible transformative ride. But I see that in the, I'm going to say, baby doulas all the time, where a lot of the time, if they ask me a question about getting started or they've done their training and then they want to do X, Y, Z, and they speak with me, and I go, yeah, but who's supporting you? And the answer is very often, well, I'm just managing, so I want to make sure that other people aren't struggling either.
Like Antonia Anderson, she does support for people wanting to become doulas now. And she even in a blog post said, okay, you want to start a business. Who's going to do the housework? And that's very gendered, but it's also a reality. It's like, are you just going to add this business to your list of things to do, or are you going to get people in to support you? Just the reality of a pile of laundry that needs doing and someone's got to do it.
Yeah, isn't that one of Julia's lines? The first person that you need to employ for your business, if you're a mum in business, is not a virtual assistant or an administrative person, but a cleaner.
Totally, yeah. In November, the November before my little one turned two, I finished up. I had a casual contract at a university and it finished up. And then at the same time, Matt got a pay rise. And so I took that as a chance to try out on my business. And so that's what I was doing with childcare time, which I had 3 days a week. And then the pandemic happened in the March, a month after my little one turned two. And at the end of March, Matt got made redundant. So he was home all the time. And then everyone was home all the time. And I just like got completely untethered. It was really stressful. So I just focused in on the business, and I was really, because I just thought I was going to do traditional in-home care. Obviously that wasn't going to happen. And I kind of lost focus and things started spinning out of control. The Black Lives Matter movement took off, as in it's been going on for years. Some people only ever heard of it in 2020, but it's been a really strong movement for a long time. It's quite an interesting organization. But that was that, even though I've always been interested in like anti-racism and stuff, but I suddenly got really into it and I started following some black people on Instagram, these great women that were doing great work, but in America. And the thing that Matt always points to is when I really lost focus, I guess I'll say, was when I signed up for an anti-racism course in America that was quite expensive and said that it was necessary for my business. I was completely focused and couldn't be convinced otherwise. And I was also being supported by people around me who weren't seeing me in the everyday. So people online who couldn't see that I really wasn't okay. And also people who I'd just been getting to know, and they didn't know what was normal. So they just thought that's just what I was like. They didn't realize that I was getting unwell. But even Matt, the day that I ended up in hospital, even though things weren't right, later, just recently, he said to me that right up until the end, I was quite normal in a way. Normal's a strange word, but I don't really know how to explain it. So one night in July 2020, I locked myself in the study and refused to help with bath time because I just reached my limit and I just couldn't give anymore. And Matt and at some points my son were like banging on the door to get me to come and help, and I just refused to come out. And so Matt did the whole routine by himself, and then I left the house through the back door and was like walking through the neighborhood, and I was going to go to my close friend's house. I was like going to walk there because they'd come over spontaneously for dinner and they'd walked. And so I just got it in my head. But it's like a 10-minute drive. So it's a really long walk. But I didn't get very far. I got like 200 meters down the road. And then there was a sign that said, wrong way, go back. And with the space that my head was in at the moment, I was like, oh, that's a sign. It means I have to go back. And I knew that if even if I did get to their house, that they would just call Matt and say, something's going on with Emmeline. Emmeline, you need to go home now. It's 10 o'clock at night or whatever. So I did walk back and I walked through the front door, and Matt hadn't even realized I'd gone out, and he was sitting watching television and looking utterly dejected. And then I won't go into the detail of what happened next, but it's probably pretty accurately described as psychosis. And I did get a bit violent and I was saying things that didn't make sense to anyone else. But for me, and this is the thing, like I, at one point when I'm feeling ready for it, I do want to read about what it's like for people who experience psychosis, what it's like on the inside, because you only ever hear about it from the outside, right? Like someone walking down the street talking to themselves, which these days, if you just put AirPods in, no one would bat an eyelid. But just like everything I said was meaningful to me, and I was trying to say something about feminism and about our religion, and it all meant something to me. But from the outside, it was not okay. It was not making sense, and it was scary, especially the violence. First, Matt called his parents, and then they called the ambulance, and then the police got called because I was being violent. I can't really remember what I did. And but then the police didn't end up coming in because I de-escalated somehow. And but I got into the ambulance and my thoughts were running in a loop, and I can't remember it now, but like I can't remember what the loop was, but it was very distressing, and it was just going really fast through this loop. But then as I started to feel better over the course of the night, the loop would get bigger, like, and slower. So I was still going around in the loop, but not as fast. But while I was in the ambulance, Matt was riding with me. My little one stayed asleep the whole time, and Matt's parents stayed at our house with him. The way I describe it is I was pretending that Matt was in labor and giving birth. So I knew that he wasn't, but I was pretending's not quite the right word. So people kept asking me what I wanted or something. And I remember saying, it's your birth. And Matt understood that I had this story that he was giving birth and he was trying to explain it to the paramedics. But this intonation, this exact wording of it's your birth came from when I was giving birth. And someone was asking me consent on something. I think it was to do with getting an episiotomy. And the assistant midwife, I was asking the doula and Matt, what should I do? What do you think? I was just trying to consult, right? And the assistant midwife said, it's your birth, in this kind of aggressive way, which I didn't like because I felt like I should be allowed to, you know, talk things through. So it was weird that that moment came up for me. And then I later realized maybe this birth wasn't as ideal as I thought. And, or even if you have a good outcome and you don't have any birth trauma, that because it is such a vulnerable time in your life, this moment of birth, that it is going to affect you. So I don't think it lasted very long, this pretending that Matt was in labor, but it was all to do with gender and role reversal and feeling like I was trapped in these gendered roles. We got to the hospital and I got into emergency and I was there all night and Matt was up all night as well. And because of being autistic, hospital is like sensory hell. And Matt was advocating for me the whole time and got me put somewhere that was not as noisy and was explaining to everyone that came, like, my behavior. He understood everything, even though it didn't make sense. Like the fact that I didn't want to go to the toilet because the toilet was a symbol of American imperialism. So even though that didn't make sense to me, he understood when I wet the bed, right? And explained that to the nurses. So in the morning, they got a psychiatrist on the phone to me. I'd recovered well enough and I just needed to get out of there. Like that was my driving force. In my head, I was like, okay, I just need to act normal enough that they'll approve me to get out of here because this is hell. And so I spoke on the phone to the psychiatrist. She was like, yep, you're fine. And then they discharged me and I went home. That should never have happened. They were fucking incompetent. That was so neglectful, but it is also in line with how the system operates, in that they admit people into psychiatric units who are in uncontrollable mental distress, which is what happened 3 days later. So because Matt was so shaken up, I mean, no, that sounds bad, like I'm blaming him. He did amazingly on that Friday night. And I basically needed him to continue that level of care in order for me to be okay. And this is what I was trying to say to people, that no one would listen to me. And because I'd done Julia's course, I knew about circles of care. So in postpartum or just in parenting, a mother is caring for a baby, breastfeeding full time, for example, or even if she's not, then she needs someone to care for her, or preferably at least two people. But then those people who are caring for her need more people to care for them. And I was like, because of this state I was in, I was very creative and I was doing lots of drawings and writing and stuff. But everyone was just focused on trying to like medicalize me. It was my perception. People weren't listening to what I was saying, which was actually really important. So by the time I ended up in hospital again, surprise, surprise, 4 days later or 5 days later, after having a couple of visits from what's called the heart team in Canberra, by the time I ended up in hospital again, Matt was beside himself. He was just so stressed and so sleep deprived and worried, and he couldn't be that intense support for me. And that's, it's not like I'm not blaming him, but this was just my perception at the time, and probably I still think it's true, but it's not like it could have gone any different. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep. It makes sense.
So when we were in hospital the second time, he was in such a bad state that he couldn't be that intense support person for me, and things just unraveled until I was like screaming at a doctor or some medical professional, I can't remember, like standing up, and he was shorter than me and he like told me to sit down, and I didn't like being told what to do. But then when he asked me to sit down, like he's like, I'm feeling scared, please sit down. Then I did sit down, which just goes to show like how we treat psychiatric clients is pretty important. But because I had done that, then they were like, right, that's it. And I actually called my doula. I called heaps of people. I was just desperate for support. I probably called you, Anna, did I?
Yeah, we spoke on the phone and messaged a bit, and it was a bit tricky because I knew that your family don't have you in the hospital unless they have actual concern.
Yeah.
But also what you were saying a lot of the time made a lot of sense.
Yeah. So anyway, I did end up getting admitted into the adult mental health unit. I was under a 10-day order, which means that you are incarcerated. That's a word that I'll use because that's effectively what it is. The authorities have decided that you are not fit to be in the outside world. So it was 10 days. Oh, no, sorry. It was a 3-day order. And then at the end of 3 days, I had an evaluation by a psychiatrist, and then he put me on a 10-day order. So I was there for about 2 weeks in the end. And while I was there, they suggested that I had bipolar disorder. And I eventually accepted that diagnosis. And that also accepting that diagnosis has been a long period of time. It's been a long journey. I had someone, actually more than one person, tell me that it was a misdiagnosis. And these were people who did not have all the information. And one of them wasn't even a mental health professional. But they were basically saying to be wary of the diagnosis because often autistic or some person they both use the word Asperger's, which I don't use. Asperger's women get misdiagnosed with bipolar. And that may or may not be true, but also bipolar often co-occurs with autism. So, but I do recognize that autism doesn't explain everything that I experience. So it's hard to tell the difference from the outside between having a special interest and mania. But I now that I have the language for it, I know what it feels like on the inside. I know what the difference is. And I've just taken really good care of myself with a lot of support. Now I know the feeling of mania, and I can take steps early on so that it doesn't, well, it's actually hypomania, which is like hypo as in H-Y-P-O, so low level, so that it doesn't develop into mania, which unchecked can develop into psychosis. But this is with bipolar 1, which is what I have. I was in hospital for 2 weeks. Matt took time off work. My little one went into the care of Matt's parents. And while I was in hospital, a house became available in the townhouse complex where Matt's parents live. Matt asked if we wanted to move house so that we could have the support there right next door. And I said, yes, that's a good idea. And so that's what we did. So they moved and I just came home to a new house. And they didn't, because it was an emergency move, they didn't do what you normally do when you move house, where you like sort through your crap a little bit, treasured belongings. And so they literally moved everything from one house into the other house. And it was quite an unsettling feeling. And I felt uncomfortable about that the whole time we lived there, because we only recently left that house like a month ago.
Coming from a massive time of mania, hospitalization, sensory overload, upheaval, to somewhere that you never really dropped anchor yourself.
No, I hated that house. It didn't have like a front door and a back door. I hated the suburb. Like, it was just fully suburbs. Like, no coffee shop that I just like independent coffee shops. So there was a chain coffee shop within a 20-minute walk, but then the closest one was like a 10-minute bike ride that was independent, but even that wasn't great. Like, it didn't have good food. I don't know. I feel like so bougie when I always talk about coffee culture, that that's really important for where I live. But at the same time, that's my class. Like, that's my background. That's who I am. Like, if that's what's important to me, then that's what's important to me. Like, having somewhere nice to go for coffee. And like, just last night, me and my little one went to, like the centre of the suburb, and a few years ago they blocked off a road and called it a pop-up park, and then people liked it so much that they made it permanent. So we went there and the kids were playing, and my little one even made a friend, which was amazing. And that would have never happened where I was. So anyway, I was there, and my son wasn't in my care for, I don't know exactly how long, but probably at least 4 months, maybe longer. And when I was trying to convince them to leave the hospital, because I left a little bit earlier than they were comfortable with, they just really wanted to be reassured that I was going to be okay. And I think they had it in their heads that I was going into a normal, quote unquote, normal caregiving situation, which women and birth parents across the country experience, which is not sustainable for anyone, but some people are able to cope with it better than I was. I was just trying to convince them that that wasn't going to happen. And if that had happened, if I had gone back to looking after my little one at the same level that I was looking after him when I went into hospital, I would have been back in hospital within the month, if not within 2 weeks. And as it was, so this goes back to what I was saying about postpartum support. I had that support, that mental health, as in practical support that I needed to get well again, that everyone deserves, but not everyone gets. And most people then would just bounce back and forth between home and psychiatric units. So I want to say this because I've gotten so much credit for how well I look after my health, but I'm like someone accepting an Oscar saying it's not all me. Like, I do look after my mental health and I take it seriously, but I'm only able to because I have the support.
And we're going to get to what that support looks like and how you're kind of, I suppose, redesigning your life away from this really nuclear family isolated kind of model, particularly in considering that, like, when you've moved states and all of those things. But yeah, what was it like at the time?
In the immediate aftermath, Matt was working 3 days a week, I think, and then it went to 4 days a week. I think it was 3 days a week. So on the nights that he wasn't going to be there in the morning, my little one would stay with his grandparents. So he would stay there 3 nights a week. They would take him to childcare. my mum was visiting town for, she was in town for 3 months, I think, and she would pick him up from childcare. So he went to childcare 2 days a week, and my mother-in-law would look after him 1 day a week. So that was, so I didn't have to do anything. I never spent time with him, but when Matt was there, and that was, and then I was able to rebuild my relationship with him in that way without having the burden of meeting his needs, as in meeting, being responsible for meeting 100% of his needs for long periods of time, which I still think is unreasonable. Because I don't like farming him out. I like spending time with him. I want to be around him pretty much all the time. Like, I do want time to myself sometimes. But what I really want is other people being around. So that was the immediate support. And then ongoing, it's fluctuated. We dropped the sleepovers, and then we dropped it down to one sleepover a week, which wasn't even necessary for us. It was just because they still wanted it for the relationship, like as in his grandparents and him himself. That was the biggest support, I guess. Now we've moved. We could have moved to Perth, Adelaide, Brisbane, Sydney, or Melbourne. And Matt had like a preferences list, and he did have Melbourne and Brisbane on his preferences list. And then he took Brisbane off because I said, I can't live anywhere where I don't have family support. So my parents both grew up in Melbourne, and all of my extended family still live in Melbourne, except for my younger sister. We moved to an area where both my aunts live. And so now I've got one aunt who's like a 10-minute drive and my other aunt who's a 5-minute drive. And they're both around heaps for babysitting. So before we left, Matt's parents were looking after my little one 2 days a week to help with this, the homeschooling, so that, you know, I could work or have other things to do. Like, we do share the homeschooling, but just having that extra support. And now we've got a nanny who fills that role. So she's here 2 days a week while Matt is overseas for 6 weeks. And then when he gets back, she's going to be coming 1 day a week.
You speak a lot to personal networks and prioritizing the support rather than the choosing of an exotic location itself. But I think also we can recognize that professional supports, childcare, whatever it is, they still form one of those circles of support around the child and the mother.
Yeah.
And your partner as well. All three of you are in the center of that circle, and those layers form around you. And professional is a layer that I think we sometimes see either as a luxury or a cop-out, and I don't think it's either of those things.
It's not a privilege, even though it is.
It's an essential.
Like, it's literally financially privileged. Like, you can't do it if you don't have the money. But, I mean, it's just the same as buying a house, right? Just because houses are priced at luxury prices doesn't mean that they're luxuries. They're essential items. And it's the same with groceries.
You need somewhere to live. You need food to eat. You need support to raise your family.
Yeah. So we kind of get gaslit into thinking that we're being spoiled when we're not. We're just trying to get our needs met. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into it in too much detail, but the support from the in-laws had an emotional cost. Like, it was really amazing, especially at the beginning. I was saying to a friend the other day, she was like, oh, it must be hard for you going to a place where you have less support. And I was like, well, the support we had had an emotional cost, and now I'm paying a financial cost. So having a bit of distance means that we can reset things in a way that's more healthy.
Yeah. You mentioned about having time to rebuild your relationship with your child without having the demands of caregiving on you 100% all the time. What's it like being in hospital away from your kid when you can't see them, and then you have to try and like rebuild the trust in them that you're not going to suddenly disappear when you really need to prioritize getting well again?
I'll start with the breastfeeding. So after the first time, I went into emergency and then got discharged the following morning. I got wheeled out in a wheelchair to the car. My parents-in-law picked us all up, and they had my little one in the car, and he like sat in my lap on the wheelchair and tried to have booby, and I said no, and I made the decision in that moment to stop breastfeeding him. Because this whole time I'd been doing it for him and not me. And it had, not that it was all his fault. And I've said that his biological desire, like his desires were completely normal and acceptable. In that moment, I just said, no, I have to look after myself. I have to focus on rebuilding myself. And so I cut it off. From the thing that made him feel secure and connected to me. And obviously, I still feel guilty about that. I've been working through my guilt about how I weaned my little one since it happened 2.5 years ago. And one time we were chatting, and you said to me, he needed you to be better, like to get better, more than he needed the milk. And that was very helpful to me. But a few months after, it was probably September, so I was in hospital July, August, and then in September, I was just so bold. I never would have done this sort of thing, but we'd never met before. But I asked you to run a weaning ceremony for me. So you came from like a 4-hour drive or something.
Look, I'm going to be honest. It sounds great that you're remembering like that, but we do also have family near where you were living, so we just combined the things.
Sure, but you did drive all the way to Canberra to run a to run a weaning ceremony for me and a circle of women who came around, and it was really important to me to have like a ceremonial ending. My little one wasn't there. There were no kids there. It wasn't about the kids at all. And actually, I love that we're friends and we've never met each other's children. Our children are not friends. Like you were saying earlier, it's not about the play dates. What do you remember of the weaning ceremony? And how did you organize a weaning ceremony when you've never done one before, I assume?
No, it is the only one that I'd done. What did we do? I brought some kind of
You brought cards.
cards, but we ended up using cards that were like kids' game cards,
Yeah,
and they
they
had
were mine.
animals on them. Yeah.
Oh, my animal
Yeah. And
cards.
so
That
we got everybody
was
to
mine.
sort through the, like, everybody was sitting in a circle just on cushions. And I don't know, we might have had some drinks or something in the middle of the circle. I can't really recall. And then we had to sort through the card and sort of introduce ourselves and our relationship to you and which animal they thought they resonated with the most, or the if you could come back in another life as an animal, which one would you choose? Something like that, just a bit of an icebreaker thing. And I think we then each spoke about our earliest memories of infant feeding. So if we remembered that we'd seen, if everybody around us either bottle fed or breastfed, or reactions that we remembered people having to public feeding, or stories about someone's mum always saying that breastfeeding was really hard for them, or whatever it was. Yeah, I don't really know what else we flowed on exactly from that,
Yeah,
but
it just flowed, didn't it?
yeah, I don't know, it was a while ago. I did have a plan, but it's.
And also, I wanted to have a mother's blessing when I was pregnant, and my sister organized one for me, but it didn't end up happening because many people couldn't make it. And so it was nice to have a women's circle that was just for me
Yeah.
around.
And I think it was about honoring that your body had sustained the life of the child that everybody in circle except me knew and loved so well. and thanking you for what you had done for him throughout his infancy and toddlerhood, and sort of drawing a line in the sand that that chapter was finished, and that there are other ways that you and your little one could feel connected.
Yeah.
That wasn't milk.
Mm.
It's interesting doing it as something that's after the fact rather than a mother blessing. It's kind of a circle of women which initiates you onto the next step that's coming.
Yeah, maybe we should have more of that.
Mm.
Like try to mark periods of time, even if it was just an age, like 2 years being a significant age, or as I mentioned earlier, 5 years, half a decade, or like, because usually that's the time when people, kids are going into school and stuff.
Yeah. I think so. Every time it's a child's birthday, I don't always execute it, but I often think of writing a message to the mother to say, congratulations.
Yeah, happy, you did it.
Happy anniversary of motherhood. You've done it.
Yeah.
So let's pause on the train of thought around the weaning for a while. You've spoken a lot about the personal supports that you had in place. What medical supports have been helpful or even unhelpful in the last 3 years?
Yeah. So I have for a long time had a mistrust of doctors, and being in the hospital system only made that more pronounced. My assigned doctor in the mental health hospital, I hated her so much. Funnily enough, my little one loved her. So he visited me twice in the hospital, and she really connected with him. And then he would talk about her like a lot after that. So that was good. And even now when I talk to him about when I was in hospital, he remembers the specific toy that she had that she gave him. And he said, can we go back to the hospital and play with that toy again? I can't remember. I think it was just blocks or something, but he loved it. So it's nice that he has some nice memories of that. So I really didn't connect with her. Then I discovered she wasn't even a psychiatrist. She was like a registrar or something. I don't know how it works. One of my best friends is an OT and she speaks fluent medical system. And she, as a part-time unpaid job, she's like a medical consultant for her family and friends. And when she is the only reason that I got the heart team to come out, because we didn't know about this stuff. They just sent us home from the hospital, told us to go to a GP. I went to a GP. I didn't go to my normal GP, the one I was telling you about earlier, who just sent me off and told me to take some vitamin B. Because I was like, he's not great. He was never my GP. Like, I never connected with him. He was just the guy that I went to. So we went to the same practice and found a guy who specialized in mental health. And he was awful. He was so bad. I was obviously really unwell, but he was very impatient with me. And he just came up with some random diagnosis and suggested that might be it. Then gave me a referral to a private psychiatrist who we didn't hear from for 2 months, who was $3,000 an hour. And we don't have health
Are
insurance.
You serious? $3,000 an hour?
Something like, I'm not very good with,
okay.
I always misread the facts, but it was pretty ridiculous.
Okay.
And it was some mate of his, and that was his duty of care, discharged. Right? And so my friend got me onto her GP, who no longer, she's moved onto something else now. And then I didn't have an appointment with her until August, which was after I got out from the hospital. But she was amazing and just very client or like patient oriented, autonomy supportive. She kept me on the medication they put me on in hospital. They wanted to take me off it and put me on lithium, but I didn't want to for various reasons. And she supported me to stay on the medication I was on for a long time until I said I was ready to change. I don't know what else to say about her, but she was amazing. She's so great. And whenever I tell her how great she is, she just says, no, you're great. You're a pleasure to have as a patient. And she has told me she's enjoyed being part of my journey. So that's my GP. I also got assigned a public psychiatrist, as in a psychiatrist within the public system. So I would see him every week or every 2 weeks initially. And I saw him from August until February. And he was great. And he sort of recognized that I'm an academic, literate person who wants all the information. And I mean, really, they should show this kind of respect to anyone. But I guess my class markers showed. So he gave me lots of papers and information. And he was also very respectful. The only thing he did once that I didn't like was he was getting me to keep a mood journal and I kept it on my phone. And then he had a student doctor in once and I handed him my phone so he could look at my mood journal. And then he like showed it to the student doctor as well without my consent, which I thought was a bit off. So he was great. And I stopped seeing him because he's like, you don't need to see me anymore. That was all free within under ACT Health. So was the hospital visit, by the way, all free. And then years later, when I did decide with my GP to change medications, I went back to the public system, but that doctor was no longer working for them, which is just the reality of the public system. And so I saw another person who I hated, but she did go through all the medication options and find one that I thought was suitable. Well, we decided together was suitable, so I changed to that. But then I decided that I wanted to have a good psychiatrist. And so I got my GP to refer me to a private psychiatrist. And I went and saw her, even though I didn't really need to because I'd already changed medications, but just to kind of touch base. And so that then I have one that I can see all the time. And she's not even that expensive. So it's like hundreds of dollars up front, but you get most of it back, which, you know, sucks to not have that money up front, which is just how the Medicare system works. But out of pocket ends up being about $40, which is pretty reasonable. And so then to have that consistency, rather than a public health person that I connect with just disappearing, which is the feeling you get, which is the same feeling that I had in hospital. I'd connect with someone or I'd put a lot of work into educating someone on my needs and accommodation requirements, and then they just disappear from my perspective. So this psychiatrist was lovely. I connected well with her. She was very supportive of my goals and everything. So that was great. And then quite a while later, like almost a year or 9 months or something, so this is just recently in January, I saw her. And she was no longer supportive of my goals because my goals had changed, which tells me that she was never supportive of my goals. I was just acting within her approval. And I always compare these systems and ways of treating people to parenting. And so it's like people say you should praise your kids, but if you're just praising them when they're doing what you want them to do, that's manipulation. You're not affirming who they are and their choices and their autonomy. And she said something that was so hurtful to me. I just talked freely to her because I trusted her. And then she came back and said to me, don't you think that when you were in that postpartum bliss that you described, don't you think that was mania? And these words really cut me because it was just not her right to define my experience when she wasn't even there. And she was just using it, seemed to me that she was using it to try and control me and my choices rather than support me in my choices. Yeah, all that to say that the medical system has a long way to go. And in fact, you like to say, Anna, that the systems aren't broken. They function as they're intended to function, which is potentially a cynical way of looking at it. But they're not intended to support people's autonomy and to support people in a systemic, society-wide supportive way to get better. I don't know what they're meant to do, but if you look at the history, like always look at the history, we haven't got that far from asylums. We've window dressed the systems and we've brought in language like They don't call us patients anymore. They call us clients, and now they call us consumers, which pretty much everyone I was in the hospital with didn't identify with that language and would correct other people for using it. But that's part of the NDIS style model of consuming services
Or
rather than.
participants is the other
Yeah, I
one.
didn't hear that one. But consumer is a big one, but that's just horrible language because we're not consumers.
It's awful.
But people being who need looking up.
And it makes the caregivers the product, but you're consuming the product.
Yeah, true. And it makes us like taking up money, like it makes it about money. And it also is like makes it about choice, but choice isn't like ultimate good. So obviously we need like choice, but it's not. Anyway, just like choice feminism isn't the best feminism. It's like, oh, it's my choice. So yeah, the medical system has been up and down. And at the moment, I've just moved interstate. I need to find a new GP. So my old GP recommended me a clinic to go to or practice or whatever you call it. And I looked them up and they all look really great, like really queer friendly. They do support, they mostly do support for refugees and stuff. So I just need to line that up. I've got a counselor that I've been seeing since 2015. So when I was really unwell, I was seeing a psychologist and then I went back to my counselor because I wasn't like critical. I was just needed support with like family relationship stuff, that kind of thing. So I'm going to have a GP. I've got a counselor. I need to get a psychiatrist. So I'll get my psychiatrist through the GP referral, just get her to find me one. I've got an osteopath in Canberra who I'm seeing through telehealth to work on my breathing.
That's interesting. I've never heard of an osteopath doing not hands-on treatment.
Well, she does do hands-on treatment, but for the breathe, like, and our initial assessment was in person, like a week before we moved. But now she can do it through telehealth because it's more like coaching me through it and stuff. But we haven't had a session yet. All of this stuff, I'm like, still need to line up. She wants me to also get an in-person osteopath and she's going to recommend me someone. Because, like, it's also about, it's about storing your experiences in your body. And I think it has to do with autism as well, possibly because life's just harder, that there's more experiences that need storing. But just the way that we operate, I don't know. I've been seeing people for years now, and eventually I just said to my osteopath, I was like, I just want a way to process things myself instead of like periodically coming to someone like you or a massage therapist and getting them to process these things out of my body. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, you probably think that I sound ridiculous.
Yeah, I think of it kind of in the way of, say you have a dream and it's a very distressing dream and you wake up in the morning and you might not remember the dream. Your body still knows that it was distressing and that you feel different and less than your best going into the day. I think that's kind of where we get to sometimes after a distressing event is that we do all this kind of talk therapy and process it with words and all of that kind of stuff. And so logically we've cleared what it is from our mind. Our mind has forgotten the really major intensity of it, but that feeling is still sitting in your body and needs to go somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
That's my thought anyway.
And that, emotions are experienced through our bodies, not through our brains. So when we have emotions, we need to process them through our bodies somehow. We can't just say, well, that's that. And that's what you and I and probably most people listening to this podcast are trying to teach our children, what we were never taught. About feeling your feelings and getting through them rather than pushing them down. Because when you push them down, they just get stuck in your body.
Yeah, I actually had this conversation with my daughter the other day. She's nearly 4 and she was really having a hard time with something. And she just kept asking me to read a book or to give her a screen or to get her food or something. And I knew that they were all distraction things. They were just because she was heightened, not because of an actual need for those things. And I said something like, seems like you're having a really hard time. I'm just going to sit here with you and help you to feel these feelings until they go away on their own. And she said, but I don't want to feel my feelings. And I was like, yeah, it's hard. It's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And we got through it.
I
was like, yeah, babe, I feel you. This is why when everything's so noisy and feels so crazy here, I'm reaching for my phone because I don't want to feel my feelings either. I get it.
I learned this analogy from Emily Nagoski, who's co-written a book with her twin sister, Amelia Nagoski, called Burnout. And they talk about emotions being a tunnel. And so that's how I use it to describe to my child. And I say, you're going through the tunnel. And so sometimes when he's crying, I will praise him. Like I was saying before, maybe it's manipulation, but I say, oh, you're doing such an amazing job. Wow, you're doing it. You're going through the tunnel. This is great. Just to reframe that for him.
So good. I'm going to save that analogy for later. Mm. And I think you've just given us a little nudge that we can take towards books. So this is the last bit that I want to ask you about before we wrap up. You read an incredible amount.
Just don't know if I do, but anyway.
A lot of the books that you have sent my way are books that are, they have a theme around motherhood, perhaps motherhood through a feminist lens. There's also books that have either characters or whose authors are from a diverse range of backgrounds and life experiences, because it can get very easy for me to just read all books by other white straight women. Which areas of reading are sparking your interest at the moment, and why you've made this new YouTube channel?
Yeah, so one of my special interests is reading. So I think I read, it's like about 65 books last year. So it doesn't feel like a lot. I feel like people who make content about reading tend to hover around the 100 book mark.
They probably don't have a five-year-old also.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I never stopped reading when I had a child. Like I remember lying in bed when my little one was a tiny baby. I used to feed him to sleep, and sometimes it would take like 40 minutes. And I have this distinct memory of reading Rants in the Dark by Emily Wright, whose newsletter I'm now subscribed to, which is amazing. Like I have a paid subscription, well worth the money, $7 New Zealand a month. But I saw that book just on display at the library. And I remember reading a section from that book where she was talking about going on her first trip without the children by herself, and that sense of freedom she felt being at an airport untethered. And she was like, if you're reading this while literally like attached to a child, you know, my thoughts go out to you or something like that. And I'm like, it me. I just didn't quit reading. And I am obsessed with reserves. So my main book source is the library. And I will see a book and then put it on reserve. And I've had to like cut down on that because my reserves just kept coming in faster than I could read them. I have released one video so far on my YouTube channel, which was about the best top 10 books I read last year. And my next video, which I haven't recorded yet, that I keep thinking about, is about reading from authors who are marginalized and avoiding reading authors who are privileged in specific ways. So I'm going to be avoiding, well, I have been avoiding this year, books by Americans, particularly white Americans, white people in general, and I've always avoided books by men because I'm a man hater. Just kidding. It's like the patriarchy exists, but it doesn't have to exist in my reading world. And when you, for example, if you're on social media, you like might follow someone and then they post at the same time that you're on social media, and then you see what they've written or whatever. And it's like bits and pieces all the time. But when you read a book, you're choosing to sit down and spend about 10 hours in that person's perspective. So you're choosing what perspective you want to be immersed in when you are deliberate about what kind of books you read. And when you read books by people who have similar identities to you, or even more privileged identities, you're not learning as much. And even when you're reading fiction, I find it interesting to learn more. And as a feminist, an inclusive feminist, so like just about social justice for everyone, it's like such a good opportunity for me. So I've been focusing more on reading books by Indigenous authors, trans authors, and Asian Australian authors. So that's been going well. At the moment, I'm reading Crying in H Mart, which is by a Korean American woman, and it's a memoir. And that's for a book club that I've recently joined since I moved back to Melbourne with some old uni friends and their friends. Did I answer your question? I feel like I've just given away the premise of the whole video, so now people won't need to watch the video when it does come out.
Yeah, but you haven't given away which books you're going to recommend within that, which is great because it means that you've already done a bit of distilling for us. You know, you're not going to be recommending ones that you thought were rubbish.
No, definitely not.
Yes, I've just finished, I think the last three books in a row that I've read are recommendations from you, actually.
Yep.
And one of them was a book that you'd sent to me as part of a care package for my late pregnancy and postpartum.
Oxytocin booster, yeah.
Yeah, oxytocin boosters, ones that didn't take too much brain power but weren't just the standard straight up romance with just plain stereotypical kind of characters.
So this is the Talia Hibbert books. Get a Life, Eve Brown, was it? No, something Eve Brown.
Yes, that was the one.
Hang on a second, I've got.
Oh, no, Act Your Age.
Oh, yeah.
Act Your Age, Eve Brown. Get a Life, Chloe Brown is the one that I haven't read.
That's the first one.
And the one,
do you want me to grab it up?
Take a Hint, Danny Brown. So it's the three Brown sisters.
So the order is Chloe, Danny, Eve. So
yes, oldest to youngest.
But it doesn't really matter because there's no spoilers. The only spoiler is, spoiler, she ends up with the guy.
Which, you know, what a surprise in that genre.
So I call this genre woke romance, but I think I'm going to have to stop doing that because the word has been ruined and now it's used as a dog whistle. But it's basically modern romance. So it's feminist. They're trying to not have stereotypes, but like you say, there is still the stereotype of the big hunky male.
Yes. But like the lead characters are from different faiths and different racial or ethnic backgrounds. Some of the lead characters are autistic,
yeah, well,
et cetera, et cetera.
I think they're all autistic, but yeah, in the Brown Sisters trilogy, but only one of them talks about autism. Only one of the books talks about autism. So I am going to do a video also about, so these books are steamy as well. I'm going to do a book that's just about steamy modern romance. I'm all about it. I love it. Just like, it's such a nice, I don't think you can tell when you're on the train or the tram. It's not like, you know, 50 Shades. Like, it just has fun covers. So it's hard to tell with modern romance. I don't think you can tell from the cover whether there's explicit material in there or not. So it's a nice secret.
No, you can't. Although I had like the ultimate mum life moment the other day where I had both the girls with me. My big one was watching a DVD and the little one was sleeping on top of me. And I was reading this book and I was like, oh, yes, I've got this so under control. And I, you know, it builds up towards the steamy part of the book. And they're just like, just on that very brink of initiating. And then my big girl's like, Mom, I need to do a poo. And that woke the baby up who started crying. And then I got jolted out of this, like, you know, steamy situation to go and assist with bathrooms and didn't get back to reading the book for another like 4 hours after that.
Right. Yeah, but maybe you had some more privacy then.
I thought that I'd have ages. I thought that I'd at least get through that chapter, but no.
was a while ago, but I read The Love Hypothesis by Ali Hazelwood, which was one that I loaned to you as well. And so what I did was, dear listener, I got these books together, I posted them to Anna, and then included a self-addressed prepaid parcel. So if you have long-distance friends, it's a nice idea. So I was like, I do want them back, but I know that admin is hard even when you don't have a newborn. So I think it worked out well. And then Anna sent me some books back as well with doing the same thing. So I read this book. I went to Brisbane for work, a work conference, and I was on the way back. So I was like waiting at the gate, reading this book. And this is, it only has one love scene in it, but it's very long. It goes for like three chapters, maybe. And I was like at the gate, reading. I was like, oh, this is getting a bit hot and heavy. And then boarding the plane, obviously I didn't read while I was boarding, but just got on, and then the whole plane ride, and then I'm just sitting there thinking, I've got a secret. I'm reading absolute smut right now and no one knows.
Yes, everyone around you is going about their business while you're reading about all sorts of unspeakable things. All right, well, we're going to put a link to Emmeline's YouTube in the show notes, and yeah, anything else that we've spoken about, I'll try and reference that too.
Yeah.
So that you have pointers on where to go. Is there anything that you want to leave as some parting words, Emmeline?
Yeah, I do have an ambition to start up an online sort of community for people like me and Anna, so feminist mothers or potentially non-binary parents. So we can talk about these sort of things. And my YouTube channel at the moment is just about books, but I am going to get on to be talking about motherhood. So I'm going to, there's this book called Obstetric Violence, which I'm hoping to read and then review. And I'm also going to be doing a video on like household equality, as in dividing the housework. So reading different books about how to do that and then analyzing it. So, I mean, it is all, the content is about books, but it's building to something else, but that's probably not going to happen for another year at least, but just putting it out there. Watch this space.
Sounds good. I'm there.
Awesome.
In the future. Future me is there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience so vulnerably. And I love the sound of where your ambitions are taking you and the way that you're intentionally crafting your new Melbourne life.
Thank you.
Bye, Emmeline.
Bye.